Solving the Climate Crisis, a new speech by Al Gore given at the NSU School of Law, September the 18th, 2006.
A few days ago, scientists announced alarming new evidence of the rapid melting of the so-called perennial ice of the North Polar Cap, continuing a trend of the last several years that now confronts us with the prospect that human activities, if unchecked in the next decade, could destroy one of the Earth's principal mechanisms for cooling itself. Another group of scientists just presented evidence that human activities are responsible for the dramatic warming of sea surface temperatures in the areas of the ocean where hurricanes form. A few weeks before that, new information from yet another team documented dramatic increases in the burning of forests throughout the American West, a trend that has increased steadily decade by decade as man-made warmer temperatures have dried out soils and vegetation. And of course, all of these findings and others come at the end of a summer with record-breaking temperatures. Indeed, the hottest 12-month period ever measured in the United States, with persistent drought over vast areas of our country. Scientific American introduces the lead article in its special issue this month on global warming with the following sentence, and I quote, "The debate on global warming is over," end quote. Well, the discussion is heading in new directions. Many scientists are now warning that we are moving closer to several tipping points that could, within as little as 10 years, make it impossible for us to avoid irretrievable damage to the planet's habitability for human civilization unless we make a good start in changing the pattern within this coming 10-year period. Speaking of tipping points, just a few weeks ago, another group of scientists reported on the unexpectedly rapid increases in the release of carbon and methane emissions from frozen tundra in Siberia, areas that are now beginning to thaw because of human-caused increases in global temperature. And the scientists tell us that the areas of tundra in danger of thawing contain an amount of additional global warming pollution that is roughly equal to the total amount that's already been deposited in the Earth's atmosphere since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Similarly, earlier this year, yet another team reported that the previous 12 months saw 32 glacial earthquakes on Greenland, each between 4.6 and 5.1 on the Richter scale, a disturbing sign that a massive destabilization may now be underway deep within the second largest accumulation of ice on the planet, enough ice to raise sea level 20 feet worldwide if it broke up and slipped into the sea. There are, it seems now, each passing day, new studies with more evidence that we are now facing a true planetary emergency, a climate crisis that demands immediate action to sharply reduce carbon dioxide emissions worldwide in order to turn down the Earth's thermostat and avert catastrophe. The serious debate over the climate crisis has now moved on to the question of how we can craft emergency solutions in order to avoid catastrophic damage. This debate over solutions has been slow to begin in earnest, not only because some of our leaders still find it more convenient to deny the reality of the crisis, but also because the hard truth for the rest of us is that the maximum that seems politically feasible still falls far short of the minimum that would be effective in solving the crisis. This no man's land or no politician zone falling between the farthest reaches of political feasibility and the first beginnings of truly effective change is the area that I would like to explore in my speech today. T.S. Eliot once wrote, "Between the idea and the reality, Between the motion and the act falls the shadow. Between the conception and the creation, between the emotion and the response, falls the shadow. My purpose is not to present a comprehensive and detailed blueprint, for that is a task for our democracy as a whole. My purpose is rather to try to shine some light in the area covered by that shadow on a pathway that lies in this terra incognita and takes us, if we choose to walk it, from where we are to where we need to go. If we acknowledge candidly that what we need to do is, in fact, beyond the limits of our current political capacities, that's just another way of saying that what we have to do is to expand the limits of what is politically possible. And that is the task before us. And I have no doubt that we can do precisely that. Because having served almost a quarter century in elected office, I do believe I know one thing about America's political system that some of the pessimists do not. That system shares something in common with the climate system. It can appear to move only at a snail's pace, but it can also cross a tipping point beyond which it can shift gears and move with lightning speed. Just as a small tumbling rock can trigger a massive landslide, America has sometimes experienced sudden massive avalanches of political change, avalanches that had their beginnings with what seemed at first like very small changes. 2 weeks ago, Democrats and Republicans joined together in California, our largest state, to pass legally binding sharp reductions in CO2 emissions. A positive step. Arnold saw my movie in June and said, "I'm going to sell my AMA." 295 American cities have now, 295 American cities have now independently ratified, if you will, and embraced CO2 reductions called for in the Kyoto Treaty. Those 85 or 86 conservative evangelical ministers that Jim mentioned publicly broke with the Bush-Cheney administration to call for bold action to solve the climate crisis as a moral issue. Business leaders in both political parties have taken significant steps to position their companies as leaders in this struggle and have adopted a policy that not only reduces CO2 but makes their companies zero carbon companies. Many of them have discovered a way to increase profits and productivity by eliminating their contributions to global warming pollution. Many Americans are now seeing a bright light shining from the far side of this no man's land, a light that illuminates not sacrifice and danger, but instead a bright future that is better for our nation in every way, a future with better jobs, a cleaner environment, a more secure nation, and a safer world. After all, many Americans are indeed tired of borrowing huge amounts of money from China to buy huge amounts of oil from the Persian Gulf to make huge amounts of pollution that destroys the planet's climate. Not a good pattern. We have to change every part of that pattern. When I visit port cities like Seattle or New Orleans or Baltimore, I find massive ships running low in the water, heavily burdened with foreign cargo or foreign oil, arriving by the thousands. These same cargo ships and tankers depart riding high, with only ballast water to keep them from rolling over. One-way trade is destructive to our economic future. We send money electronically in the opposite direction. But we can change this pattern by inventing and manufacturing new solutions to stop global warming made right here in America. I still believe in good old-fashioned American ingenuity. We need to fill those ships with new products and technologies that we create that can be used around the world to turn down the global thermostat. Working together, we can create jobs and simultaneously stop global warming. But we must begin by winning the first key battle against inertia and against the fear of change. In order to conquer our fear and walk boldly on that path that lies before us, we have to insist on a higher level of honesty in America's political dialogue. Is that too much to ask? When we make big mistakes in America, it is usually because the people have not been given an honest accounting of the choices before us. It is also often because too many in both parties who knew better did not have the courage to do better. Our children have a right to hold all of us to a higher standard when their future and the future of all human civilization is now hanging in the balance. They deserve better than the spectacle of censorship of the best scientific evidence about the truth of our situation and harassment of honest scientists who are trying to warn us about the looming catastrophe. They deserve better than politicians who sit on their hands and do nothing to confront the greatest challenge that humankind has ever faced, even as the danger bears down on us. We in the United States have a particularly important responsibility, after all, because the world still regards us, in spite of our recent moral lapses, as the natural leader of the community of nations. Simply put, in order for the world as a whole to respond urgently to the climate crisis, the United States must lead the way. No other nation can. Developing countries like China and India have gained their own understanding of how threatening the climate crisis is to them, but they will never find the political will to make the necessary changes in their growing economies unless and until the United States leads the way. Our natural role is to be the pace car in the race to stop global warming. So what would a responsible approach to the climate crisis look like if we had one in America? Well, first of all, I think we should start by immediately freezing CO2 emissions and then beginning sharp reductions. Merely engaging in high-minded debates about theoretical future reductions while continuing to steadily increase emissions represents a self-delusional and reckless approach. In some ways, that approach is worse than doing nothing at all because it lulls the gullible into thinking that something is actually being done when, in fact, it is not. An immediate freeze has the virtue of being clear, simple, and easy to understand. It can attract support across partisan lines as a logical starting point for the more difficult work that lies ahead. I remember those days a quarter century ago when Jim and I had talks about nuclear arms control. I was the author of a complex nuclear arms control plan to deal with the then rampant arms race between our country and the former Soviet Union. And at the time, I was strongly opposed to the nuclear freeze movement, which I saw as simplistic and naive. And it didn't do enough anyway. But three quarters of the American people understood it and supported it. And as I now look back on those years, I see things differently. I see more clearly now that the outpouring of public support for that very simple and clear mandate served to change the political landscape and make it possible for more detailed and sophisticated proposals to eventually be adopted. When the politicians are paralyzed in the face of a great threat, our nation needs a popular movement, a rallying cry, a standard, a mandate that is broadly supported on a bipartisan basis. And I believe a freeze can be such a standard. A responsible approach to solving this crisis would also involve joining the rest of the global economy and playing by the rules of the World Treaty that reduces global warming pollution by authorizing the trading of emissions within a global cap. At present, the global system for carbon emissions trading is, of course, as you know, embodied in the Kyoto Treaty, and it drives reductions in CO2 and helps many countries that are a part of the treaty find the most efficient ways to allocate capital and meet their targets for reductions. It is true that not all countries are yet on track to meet their targets. Many are not. But the first targets don't have to be met until 2008, and the largest and most important reductions typically take longer than the near term in any case. The absence of the United States from that treaty means that 25% of the world economy is missing. It is like filling a bucket with a large hole in the bottom. When the United States does eventually join the rest of the world community in making this system operate well, the global market for carbon emissions will instantly become a highly efficient closed system, requiring every corporate board of directors on Earth to exercise a fiduciary duty to aggressively manage and reduce CO2 emissions in order to protect shareholder value. Many American businesses that now operate in other countries that are signatories to the treaty already have to abide by it anyway. And unsurprisingly, they are the companies that have been most eager to adopt these new principles here at home as well. The United States and Australia are the only two countries in the developed world that have not yet ratified the treaty. I'm well aware that since the treaty has been so demonized in America's internal debate, it is difficult to imagine the current Senate finding a way to ratify it. But the United States should immediately join the discussion that is now underway on the new tougher treaty, now under negotiation, that will soon be completed. We should plan to join it, to accelerate its adoption, and phase it in more quickly than is presently planned. Third, a responsible approach to solving this crisis would avoid the mistake of trying to find a single magic silver bullet that will somehow solve the problem. We should recognize instead that the answer will involve what Bill McKibben has called silver buckshot. Numerous important solutions, all of which are hard, but no one of which is by itself the full answer for our problem. One of the most productive approaches to the multiple solutions we need is a roadmap designed by two Princeton professors, Rob Sokolow and Stephen Pakala, which breaks down the overall problem into more manageable parts. Sokolow and Pakala have identified 15 or 20 large building blocks, or wedges as they present them, that can be used to solve our problem effectively, even if we use only 7 or 8 out of the 15 or 20. It has been a fruitful approach to a rich discussion. I am among the many who have found this approach useful as a way to structure the choices that lie before us. Over the next year, I intend to convene an ongoing, broad-based discussion of solutions that will involve leaders from government, science, business and labor, agriculture, grassroots activists, faith communities, and others. I am convinced that it is possible to build an effective consensus in the United States and in the world at large on the most effective approaches to really solve this climate crisis. Many of those solutions will be found in those building blocks that currently structure so many discussions. But I'm also certain that some of the most powerful solutions will lie beyond our current categories of building blocks and wedges. Our secret strength in America has always been our capacity for vision. Make no little plans, one of our most famous architects said over a century ago, they have no magic to stir men's blood. We need big solutions that run across the categories And I look forward to the deep discussion and debate that lies ahead. But there are already some solutions that seem to stand out as particularly promising. First among them, dramatic improvements in the efficiency with which we generate, transport, and use energy will almost certainly prove to be the single biggest source of sharp reductions in global warming pollution. Because pollution has been systematically ignored in the old rules of America's accounting and marketplace, there are lots of relatively easy ways to use new and more efficient options to cheaply eliminate the pollution. Since pollution is, after all, waste, business and industry usually do become more productive and efficient when they systematically go about reducing pollution. And so many of the technologies on which we still depend are actually so old and outdated that they're just inherently far less efficient than the exciting modern newer technologies that are now available that we haven't started using yet. One of the examples of a switch we need to make is one I've discussed before, the internal combustion engine. When scientists calculate the energy content in BTUs of each gallon of gasoline used in a typical car, and then measure the amounts wasted in the car's routine operation, they find that an incredible 90% of that energy is completely wasted. One engineer, Amory Lovins, has gone farther and calculated the amount of energy that is actually used to move the passenger, excluding the several tons of metal that we take with us everywhere we go when we drive cars. And he found that only 1% of the energy is actually used to move the person from point A to point B. And that is, after all, the point of the exercise. But 99% is wasted. And this is more than an arcane calculation or a parlor trick with arithmetic. These numbers actually do illuminate the single biggest opportunity to make our economy more efficient and competitive while sharply reducing global warming pollution. It is a major source of hope as well as opportunity. To take another example, a great many of our older factories use similarly obsolete processes that generate prodigious amounts of waste heat. Heat that is thrown away, if you will, but which actually has tremendous economic value. And by redesigning their processes and capturing that waste, they can eliminate huge amounts of global warming pollution while saving billions of dollars and becoming more competitive at the same time. When we introduce the right incentives for eliminating pollution and becoming more efficient, many businesses will begin to make greater use of computers and advanced monitoring systems to identify even more opportunities for savings. I mention this because our most powerful new set of tools in the 21st century is computers. It lies with computers and information processing. And this is what happened in the computer chip industry when more powerful chips led to better computers, which in turn made it possible to design even more powerful chips in a virtuous cycle of steady improvement that became known to all of us as Moore's Law. We may well see the emergence of new versions of Moore's Law producing steadily higher levels of energy efficiency at steadily lower cost. We stand on the threshold of a new era in which large parts of our economy are beginning to shift to a more granular level where there will literally be an accounting for matter molecule by molecule and energy electron by electron. There is yet another lesson we can learn from America's success in the information revolution. When the internet was invented, and I assure you I intend to choose my words carefully here, it was because defense planners in the Pentagon 40 years ago were searching for a way to protect America's command and communications infrastructure from being disrupted in a nuclear attack. The network they created, known as ARPANET, was based on distributed communication. Some people refer to it as packet switching, a system that allowed it to continue functioning even if major portions of it were destroyed. Well, today our nation faces threats very different from those we countered during the Cold War. We worry today that terrorists might try to inflict great damage on America's energy infrastructure by attacking a single vulnerable part of the oil distribution or electricity distribution network. So, taking a page from the early pioneers of ARPANET, we should develop a distributed electricity and liquid fuels network that is less dependent on large coal-fired generating plants and vulnerable oil ports and refineries. Small windmills and photovoltaic solar cells distributed widely throughout the electricity grid would sharply reduce CO2 emissions and at the same time increase our energy security. Likewise, widely dispersed ethanol and biodiesel production facilities would shift our transportation fuel stocks to renewable forms of energy while making us less dependent on and vulnerable to disruptions in the supply of expensive crude oil from the Persian Gulf, Venezuela, and Nigeria, all of which are extremely unreliable sources upon which to base our future economic vitality. It would also make us less vulnerable to the impact of a Category 5 hurricane hitting coastal refineries or to a terrorist attack on ports or other parts of our infrastructure. Just as a robust information economy was triggered by the introduction of the Internet, a dynamic new renewable energy economy can be stimulated by the development of a widely dispersed electronet or smart grid that allows individual homeowners and business owners anywhere in America to use their own renewable sources of energy to sell electricity into the grid when they have a surplus and purchase it from the grid when they don't. The same electronet could give homeowners and business owners accurate and extremely powerful information tools with which to precisely measure how much energy they are using where and when and identify opportunities for eliminating unnecessary costs and wasteful usage patterns. A second group of building blocks to solve the climate crisis involves America's transportation infrastructure and vehicles. We could further increase the value and efficiency of a distributed energy network by retooling our failing auto giants, GM and Ford, to require them and assist them in switching to the manufacture of flex fuel plug-in hybrid vehicles. The owners of such vehicles would have the ability to use electricity as a principal source of power, charging at night when the peak load is lowest, evening the capacity of the network, and then to supplement that power by switching from gasoline to ethanol or biodiesel. This flexibility would give them incredible power in the marketplace to push the entire system to much higher levels of efficiency and in the process again sharply reduce global warming pollution. This shift would also offer the hope of saving tens of thousands of good jobs in American companies that are presently hemorrhaging those jobs, fighting a losing battle, trying to sell cars and trucks that are just less efficient than the ones made by their competitors from countries where they were forced to reduce their pollution and thus became more efficient. It is, in other words, time for a national oil change. And that's apparent to anyone who has looked at our national dipstick.
You are listening to Al Gore's speech, Solving the Climate Crisis, given at the NSU School of Law, September 18, 2006. That's part one of two.